shooting from the lip.
We're taking no prisoners here. Real opinions for real people.
John Gaunt, shooting from the lip.
Hi, good afternoon, and welcome to another edition of Shooting From The Lip on Sputnik International with me, John Gaunt. Got you a great guest today, Michael Heaver. He was a Brexit Party MEP for a very short space of time, of course, because we got out of the EU, didn't we? But what's he doing now? What's his view on what's happening in the world? He is a well-known media and social commentator, and I'm delighted to say he joins me now.
Shooting from the lip.
Good afternoon, Michael.
Hi, John. How you doing, mate?
I'm brilliant. Well, how are you doing? What is life after being a Brexit MEP? Tell me.
Well, you know what? It's one of those things where we were in a very unique position in that we weren't exactly sure how long our term was going to be. And obviously, I'm delighted that we've left. But it's one of those rare feelings of actually really achieved something in office. You know, I was saying we came, we saw, we won. That was our job, to go to Brussels, to Strasbourg, here in the UK, to make sure that we got Brexit over the line, that we made sure those that were pushing for a second referendum, they wanted to scrap the entire thing, John, if you remember. They were lining up in Westminster to cancel that 2016 referendum vote. And I played my own small part as MEP, one of the last ever British MEPs, and damn, that feels good to say, to make sure that the pro-Brexit majority could not be ignored. And as I say, a unique feeling to feel that you went for that job of a relatively small time in that role and actually achieved emphatically what we set out to do. So a great feeling.
Do you think the Brexit we've got is the Brexit that we voted for, though, on Independence Day? Your ex-leader, of course, said it was Brexit in name only and then seemed to change his mind. What do you make of Boris's Brexit?
Well, what happened with the Brexit Party was the pressure that was put on sort of stiffened some of the language. And what we ended up was with Boris Johnson saying that we were not going to go for political alignment with the European Union and that we were going to go for a Canada-style free trade deal. Now, to be fair to the government, to be fair to Boris, to be fair to the Conservatives, every step of the way so far, they are sticking to that. And I think what you have to remember in politics, I mean, just compare where we are now with this government with where we were with Theresa May's government. Theresa May's government wanted to sign us up to something called the backstop, which would have effectively kept us under EU control until or unless the EU gave us the say-so to ever leave it. It would have been a complete and utter catastrophe for our country. So actually, I'm quite optimistic. I think we've come a hell of a long way. And actually now you see the EU, now they're having a bit of pressure put on them in terms of the negotiations. They are absolutely all over the place. People remember Donald Tusk of the EU. He was saying a couple of years ago, oh yes, of course, the Brits can have a Canada-style deal if they want. Michel Barnier is now coming into out and saying, oh no, you can't have that because you're a different case. And what this really gets the heart to, well, the EU are apt, and I saw it time and time again over there. What they are terrified of is the UK breaking free properly and gaining competitive advantage. So what they're trying to do at the moment is say, oh, we'll give you a free trade deal, but only if you sign up to what they call the level playing field, which basically means you sign up to what their sort of policies and regulations on state aid, on the environment, all this stuff. Well, no, sorry. What we want and what we must have as an independent country now is the right for our government to decide whatever policy it wants and for that to be determined at elections. And we must reject any effort by the European Union, because imagine this, John, imagine in future years, if being outside the EU, if we have a Labour and the Conservatives and they're talking about the next general election about policies, and they still say, even outside, well, we can't have that policy because Brussels wouldn't like it. That doesn't work, does it? And I don't actually think that's where we're going to end up. The government so far, I think, are doing a pretty good job. And that's because the Brexit Party put the pressure on, and Boris Johnson so far and his government, a massively different tone from what we had under Theresa May, and quite encouraging.
OK, so then are we going to get a pretty hard Brexit, in your opinion, over this next 12 months?
I don't buy into this hard or soft Brexit nonsense, John, I'm afraid. I think there's only one, you know, ultimately Brexit is about breaking free from EU control. If you allow the EU to maintain policy control over domestic affairs in your country, then that's not what people voted for. They voted so that we can have a government that determines the laws, that runs our own country, and that breaks free from the stranglehold of the European Union. And by the way, one of the most interesting things that I found as an MEP as well is there are a hell of a lot of Eurosceptic MEPs from all sorts of countries who say, look, Mike, behind the scenes, you know, publicly right now, we can't advocate for our countries to leave the EU completely because that would be seen as too radical and all the rest of it. But what they're saying is, we hope that you lead the way, because privately, we want our country out of this complete EU mess as well. And actually, I think, you know, with a government with some bottle in this country, you may well see other countries saying, well, look, okay, if we can have cooperation and trade, but determine our own policies, our own regulations, control our own borders, we'll have a bit of that as well.
Okay, so that's where we are with Boris. We're going to talk later about coronavirus in the programme and Boris's reaction to that. I mean, obviously, it's a major challenge to him. But let's talk about this budget that has been delivered. What do you make of it? I thought it was a bit like Viv Nicholson. You're probably too young to remember her. She was the big pools winner in the 60s who decided to spend. It felt like that in the budget. Do you think it was a good, strong budget?
I think so. And I mean, look, poor old Rishi Sunak, he's obviously now the Chancellor. He's came basically from nowhere, pretty much an unknown to Chancellor. And my mind, what a time to become Chancellor. Incredibly important budget, of course, given coronavirus, which I know we'll talk about later. But a £30 billion spending package, talking about measures to scrap business rates for hundreds of thousands of shops, cinemas, restaurants, music venues and all the rest of it. And also a £1 billion government-backed loan scheme for businesses that are going to be hit by the damage impact of the virus is likely to have. I think what people need to realise with Boris Johnson, this government, is they take, I think, very seriously the idea that a lot of Labour voters outside of London, up north, lent their vote to the Conservatives. And for a lot of former Labour voters, that was a very difficult thing to do. It was a hell of a big step, but the Labour Party had moved so far away from the sort of politics that they believe in, that they then voted Conservative for the first time. So what the Conservatives need to do, and what I think they do understand, is that that support up north in constituencies, John, that never, ever had a Conservative MP before, there were a lot of them, they are now looking at a policy agenda where they're actually going to have to invest, where they're actually going to have to try and economically and geographically change the country slightly, because we are such a London-centric country in so many ways, in terms of the media, in terms of a lot of the wealth, in terms of a lot of the business. And I think outside the regions, that over many decades has really started to bite and people have had enough of it. They want to see a rebalancing.
And do you feel that's why, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn's reply was stumbling. He didn't seem to have an answer to it because, in a sense, today, Boris and his brand new Chancellor, who, by the way, I'm very impressed with, he seemed to take or steal their clothing. This was a spend budget on public services, roads, as you say, railways and the rest of it. But he didn't only steal their clothes. I felt that he stole some of Nigel Farage's. What did you think?
Well, yeah, I mean, Rishi Sunak, I just, you know, think how far we've come on this front, John. Rishi Sunak is a chancellor who said when he was an MP before this role, he said, we don't actually need a free trade deal with the EU. We can go WTO. We can go, you know, what was deemed to be at times a no deal Brexit. Now, compare that to Philip Hammond, right, who was out there as our chancellor when he was chancellor, actively lobbying against that. This is, people need to appreciate the difference of this government and the personnel involved, Rishi Sunak, Boris Johnson, compared to the Conservative government we had before, is very, very different. And in my view, much, much better. But you're right. You know, Jeremy Corbyn, you know, the fact, John, that he's still the Labour leader.
I know,
I mean,
it's
why
incredible.
Are they, why on earth have they not just put an old hand in as a sort of, you know, sort of caretaker role, who might have been able to give it a bit of a fresh face for a few months until they'd voted for their leader, to have him there staggering around?
I know. Well, just on that subject, you say staggering around. What about Piers Morgan? I mean, he won on a technical knockout against Lisa Nandy the other day. What is all this obsession? Don't get me wrong, but what is this obsession with the trans rights movement? And how come that is now out trumping feminism? I can't quite get my head around it.
You know, it's really interesting, John, whether you talk about the Brexit vote here in the UK or the Trump vote in America or the latest general election, I always thought that the other side would try and take note of where they were going wrong and why they lost. But actually, on each occasion, all you've seen is the other side increasingly talking to themselves. And you're right. I mean, this Labour leadership contest has been so fringe and peripheral. And look, I know that the Labour contenders like Nisa Nandi are trying to appeal to Labour members. And, you know, the Labour members, let's face, are way out of step of the country. I mean, I saw a poll the other day that said the majority of Labour members actually want to abolish the monarchy, for instance. We're about to. But, you know, I mean, that just gives you a clue of where they are as a party. But the Labour Party are just talking to themselves, as you say. Some of this stuff's madness. I saw that GMB clip with Piers Morgan. I mean, I'd love to see some polling on that, but I bet you it's about 90-10 split public opinion and Piers Morgan's view on that. I think some of this stuff's just gone absolutely insane. But it's not just on that issue. I mean, Keir Starmer the other day, looking like he will probably win it, refused to rule out campaigning to rejoin the EU.
Yeah.
And I've also seen all of the Labour leadership contenders talk about potentially bringing back open borders. Now, can you imagine in some of these Labour working class seats that they need to win back, the Conservatives, having delivered Brexit, having put in place border controls to bring down levels of immigration, the Labour Party's manifesto is going to say, oh no, we'll do away with all that and we'll bring back open borders. That's what the Labour leadership contenders are saying. It is unbelievable.
But here's a thought for you. Maybe they've decided, these momentum mob, the Twitterati, the woke population, that they don't need to be in power. They don't need to win the American election. They don't need to win Brexit. They don't need to win the British general election, because in a sense, they've infested every single area of public life with their woke agenda. Am I right or wrong?
Well, no, I think it's absolutely fair to say that a lot of the institutions do have that sort of mindset. I mean, you look at the Priti Patel thing, for example. The thing that really disgusted me about some of the briefing that's gone about Priti Patel, the Home Secretary. And again, she's a woman that's trying to get in there. She's got a democratic mandate. She's trying to get the right things done, in my opinion. Now, I saw that civil servants from the Home Office have been putting allegations to her, not to internally through HR, not even to journalists, going to the Labour Party directly with allegations against Priti Patel. And it's all well and good for people to say, oh, it's all a big conspiracy. What the hell are civil servants who work in the Home Office going to the Labour Party to brief against the Home Secretary? I mean, that is absolutely bang out of order.
And I guess this is a battle that she, and not just she, but indeed Boris Johnson, has to win. If he lets Priti go, then he's never, because that civil service, I believe, again, is infested by people who'd never wanted to leave the EU, so-called cultural Marxists, if you fancy, the common purpose commandos. They could derail this government. If she falls, it could all fall. This was all before coronavirus, of course.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, John. I think the Priti Patel case is really, it's, you're either going to stand up to some of this sort of establishment attempt to take down such a prominent and well-liked figure, or you're going to fold and back down. And all too often, those, if you, I don't know if you want to call it on the Conservative side or on the right, after a bit of shouting and stuff on social media and a few thousand people that are quite militant mouthing off, you know, sometimes they back down. They need to absolutely not back down. And actually, that gets to a wider point in terms of these Twitter storms, John, because, I mean, I've been spending a bit less time on social media. Frankly, I think Twitter, I mean, I don't know if you saw, you know, we'll probably talk about it later, but Nadine Dorries coronavirus.
Yeah, horrendous things to say.
You know, what on earth? Why are people behaving like this, John?
Well, they've been saying they hope she dies and that other people in the party get it. I mean, this is a serious, serious virus. And to me, you put politics aside when it comes to somebody who's been infected, don't you?
Of course you do. And I think social media actually now is exposing. There's actually some people out there in this sort of political who are so fanatical that they are willing to use something like somebody getting a virus or a disease and celebrating it. I mean, what is this shows you actually how entrenched and how crazy some of these people are and how militant they are and how dangerous they are, actually.
So you think the whole be kind hashtag after Caroline Flack was a load of nonsense?
Well, no, that's absolutely the way that we should behave. And, you know, as I say, I've just been spending loads less time on Twitter, to be honest with you, because every time I go on there, people are having stupid arguments. Yeah. It's just getting nasty. There's, you know, no one's even listening to the other side in a lot of these. You know, it's very personal. You know, we as a country actually are not like that. And what the big mistake that the left make and a lot of the Corbynistas is, they start to think, oh, Twitter's representative of the country. It is not. If we were a country that was obsessed with the woke, you know, agenda, and, you know, the BBC, I must say as well, just absolutely obsessed with race, with gender, with sexuality, if that is where we were as a country, then you would have seen a Jeremy Corbyn landslide and he'd be in number 10. The fact is, he got an absolute shellacking, right? That's not where we are as a country. It's not, but in my experience in this country, it's we're not a country that's obsessed with this sort of ridiculous politically correct nonsense that's just focusing all the time on division and trying to, you know, define people by, like I said, either their gender or their sexuality or their race. That's not who we are as a country.
Okay.
And I think, you know, on Twitter, you get the extreme people pushing, constantly banging on about this, and I just think it's very, very fringe and very unrepresentative of the debate that's going on with a man in the street.
I agree with you entirely. That's Michael Heaver shooting from the lip. We'll have a short break, and then when we come back here on Sputnik International, we'll talk about the king and queen of woke culture, Harry and Meghan, and then we'll talk about Boris Johnson and how he's coping with coronavirus. You are listening to John Gaunt. This is Shooting from the Lip. This is Sputnik International.
Shooting from the lip.
We're taking no prisoners here.
Real opinions for real people.
John Gaunt, shooting from the lip.
Hi, welcome back to Sputnik International with my special guest today, Mr. Michael Heaver, the former Brexit MEP. Michael, I agreed with what you were saying about woke culture in the first half of the show. Tell me about Harry and Meghan. It's the longest farewell tour in history, and it's getting right on my you-know-whats. What about you?
Obviously, there's been some severe disagreements there. You can see the body language between Harry and his brother. You can just see that, right? They were in an event the other day. I saw that Harry, at one of his last events, you know, received a rousing reception and was quite emotional. I just think the whole thing's quite sad. And actually, I suspect actually that Harry and Meghan will end up coming back to the UK in the long term. They obviously want a different sort of celebrity life. I don't know. You know, they want to go and do their own thing. That's fine. But, you know, people are going to obviously, and they're right to say, well, they don't get all the bells and whistles of the sort of public expense that goes with it.
So you think the Queen was right to stand up to them?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, the Queen is obviously an amazing woman. She's been around for decades. She has seen it all. She's dealt with it the best she can at the end of the day. It's not an easy situation. Family isn't easy, especially when it's in the public eye, John. You know, I try and, as much as I like to weigh on things, I try not to be too judgmental. You know, you don't really know what's going on behind the scenes there, what's being said, who's thinking what. All I will say is that I think the Queen has dealt with it absolutely as best she can. And, you know, if Harry and Meghan want a very different life and want to go and live in Canada and all this, then good luck to them. But, you know, I think the British public are right to say, well, OK, hang on a minute. We don't want to fund your lifestyle then, if that's what you want to do.
OK, let's move on about and talk about coping with things. Coronavirus, of course. I don't know who it was who said politics isn't about policies. Politics is about events, dear boy. Well, coronavirus proves that, doesn't it? What do you make of how Boris and this government has reacted to this threat? First of all, are you taking it seriously?
I am taking it seriously. I mean, I think keep calm and carry on is the best thing to do. I think this is going to be quite severe in terms of disruption. I think that Nigel Farage, funny enough, was one of the people that was actually saying, well, wait a second, what's going on with flights here? We've got people coming in, you know, from Italy and other places where obviously the whole of Italy is in massive lockdown. I saw a figure earlier that was quite concerning, John. I think Lombardy, which I think is sort of the hardest hit part of Italy at the moment, the mortality rate there of those that are getting is now 8%. Now that is pretty high. And I think the fact now that you've seen BA, Ryanair, they stopped all Italian flights.
Hang on a minute. Why didn't the government do that? My daughter went to Italy for a day. She has been working over there, but she had to go back for a business meeting. She went on the Saturday. When she got to Milan, there were people in hazmat suits testing her temperature. When she flew back the next day on Sunday to Birmingham, nobody there. And do you know what? They're still not checking at the airports. And the government didn't stop the flights. Economics has stopped the flights. Do you not feel that Boris has been slow off the blocks on this one?
I think it's hard to say, John. I think we're going to have to see how this all plays out. Different countries are taking different approaches. What I would say is that the thing that's going to be very difficult is if we see large-scale advice for people to work from home, I think the concern is that if you tell people and you try and go too hard too early, in the end, when it peaks, people think, oh, it's all blown over, forget about it, I'm going to go back out to the pub, I'm going to go and watch the footy and all the rest of it. And then actually that can make the situation worse.
Well, I accept that, but the opposite argument to that is, and I've got Italian friends who are stuck in this mire at the moment, when Conti closed down the north of Italy, they all jumped on trains to get to the south. So he had to impose almost, and I use this term advisedly, martial law. Well, that could well happen in this country, Michael.
Could do. I mean, we may have to see, you know, I think with the way it's going, and of course this situation could change, but based on the projections, you know, the advice to self-contain and for those that aren't feeling well not to go into work and work from home, etc., is going to be quite a widespread thing in terms of international travel and things like that. I mean, blimey, New York, you can get return flights at the minute for £250, I saw someone put on Twitter. So, and but you know, there's no point going there because the place is pretty much on, you know, I think a lot of the public transport and things like that is all being affected. So not sure how much fun you'd have over there.
So Nadine Norris has gone down with it. So is somebody else in her office and another MP we're getting reported now. Some people, in fact, several people, MPs, are saying Boris Johnson should have a test as well because he's been mixing with her. But he says, I'm not having one. I just think that's do as I say and not do as I do, isn't it?
The interesting thing is today, obviously, with the budget, you've got all the MPs there in very close quarters in that House of Commons, very, you know, very close together. And it's that argument, isn't it, that if people are soon going to be told that they can't gather in, you know, whether it's bars or, I don't know, football games or whatever, then why are MPs all crammed together in Parliament right now? I guess, you know, all they can do is listen to the medical advice, I guess, and then this is the approach they're taking. I mean, it'll be interesting to see if things in this country do become like Italy or not. I'm not sure.
Yeah, because, of course, Italy delayed, didn't they? And they're the same kind of numbers as we have 2 weeks ago, and look where they are now. Different cultures, I understand, different countries. So what do you make? I mean, I know you're a massive football fan. What do you make of the fact that the Arsenal game's cancelled? Or last week they were saying footballers shouldn't shake hands, as if that's going to help footballers all over each other in the penalty area. It's pathetic, isn't it?
Well, I was at the last two Chelsea games, so I was at Stamford Bridge twice in the last week. Absolutely two fantastic performances, I will say. Two clean sheets as well. I mean, I've been in big stadium over the last week two times. So, I mean, you know, public gatherings are going on. Also, I don't really see how. Are they seriously saying that the rest of the football season is going to be played behind closed doors?
The suggestions for that, what they should be saying is, we're going to just take a break and it will come back later in the year, surely. You can't have football behind closed doors, can you?
It doesn't work. It's bizarre. I mean, we've seen a few games being played already. I mean, look, John, I'm not going to be judgmental. At the end of the day, I'm with you. Whatever action needs to be taken, needs to be taken. But, you know, I think people just need to try. I mean, all these donuts, by the way, running around filling their trolleys with toilet roll. I mean, what on earth are they playing at? That is one thing, actually, that really got back to the people I know around in Essex where I live. They were saying, who are these selfish people that are going around and filling up trolleys with stuff? You know, just try and be sensible. Just try and be sensible. Apply some common sense.
Okay, common sense then. How about Cheltenham? Now, I'll put my cards on the table. I'm a great fan of the Cheltenham Festival, but I believe it should have been cancelled this year. I think it's ridiculous that 60,000 people... I know it's outside, but this virus is transmitted from droplets. So whilst you're holding your Guinness and shouting and screaming, you are spitting over other people. It should have been cancelled. What about you?
Well, there's going to have to be some consistency, isn't there, John? I mean, if football games are going to get cancelled and big public gatherings like that, then you've either got to cancel them all or you've got to let them all go ahead, surely. I don't see how you could have some gatherings of 40, 50, 60,000 people go ahead and other ones get cancelled. So the government need to make a decision on this and they need to explain it. And I think if they do that and explain it clearly, then, you know, people short term will be OK.
I think that's the problem, though. They haven't really got a policy and they haven't really explained it. We'll come back to that in a moment. What about schools being closed? There's a petition, and we speak today at Wednesday late afternoon. It's nearly 300,000 people saying close the schools. Where do you start? Now, kids don't get it by the look of it, but they are super spreaders. Your opinion?
There's different approaches. If you've got all the information, you can make that decision, can't you? But, you know, ultimately, I don't think just shutting the country down is something that you do lightly. I don't think it's something you rush into. What I also think, by the way, is that you're going to see areas and pockets that are much more affected based on the demographics of age and whether it's there's a lot of elderly people there, because obviously we've heard that they're the most affected. So I think some areas you probably will see school closures and some you may not. I'm not sure it's going to be a complete, but you know, I could be wrong. But certainly in Italy, it was at first a regional, more localised approach, and then it became national later. So you may see that here as well.
Okay, let's move on. Let's talk about the BBC. You hinted at some criticism of them in the first half of the show. Where are the BBC? Are the BBC going to survive?
I don't think so. I mean, not in the current form. You can't, the licence fees are a total and utter relic. The fact that, you know, and it's fair to say now, I mean, I increasingly, I've got sort of smart TV, like a lot of people have, most people have, and I just go on things like YouTube now. YouTube, your Netflix, things like that. Certainly to a generation younger than me, the idea that you pay for a service that you don't use, and I think it's legitimate now and realistic for people to say, I don't actually use BBC services. I don't use BBC News. I don't watch BBC programmes. I mean, even Match of the Day, John, if you think about it, on YouTube now, Sky and BT Sports put the, about 5 minutes after the game's end, they stick the highlights up on YouTube anyway. So Match of the Day, which was one of the, pretty much like one of the only things I watch. And by the way, why the hell have they got Gary Lineker earning millions doing that when they employ a load of football journalists that they could just got to present it? That's another thing. I mean, some of the wages, I mean, the BBC should have a wage cap, in my opinion. No one should become a millionaire doing public service broadcasting. This is absolutely ridiculous. It should be where the young talent comes up, the young blood comes up, the payments are less, and then they can go into the private sector if they want. But I think the whole culture of the BBC and the whole funding model is ultimately doomed, because it comes back to a very simple point. If people don't want to pay for a service, why should you be able to force them to?
Okay, what about bias and the BBC? And bias indeed in the whole of the MSM. There you are. You've had 6 or 7 months being a Brexit MEP. I was talking to Martin Daubney about this, and he said, I'm not really getting the phone ringing off the hook for more TV appearances. Is that kind of the same with you? And do you think there is a bias to anybody on the right? I mean, you've set up your own Brexit Boys podcast. Is that because you're not getting that exposure? Do you think it still is very left orientated?
Although, yeah, me and Martin Daubney have done the Brexit Bros podcast, which we have great fun doing, absolutely. But I think Sky News have always been fair to me. They give me a crack of the whip. The BBC, I've done a little bit, but largely none at all. I mean, I think ultimately one of the problems that we've got in this country still, I want to see the media sector completely deregulated. So it seems crazy to me that we've only got, for instance, less than a handful of 24 hours news channels. We should have a plethora. I would deregulate it massively. I would allow, I mean, you look at the rise of things like talk radio and LBC and all sorts of other things and podcasts. You should be able to have, as they do in America, in my opinion, editorially driven content. I mean, the idea, by the way.
So let me get this clear. Like the newspapers, they can have a political slant, they can have a bias. There's no problem with that. You're saying that TV news should be like that too.
Absolutely. So you can have Guardian news if you want. You can have the Daily Mail news. You can have whatever you want, and you can have it presented, and people have their individual shows. They can put their own viewpoints. They can invite and say what the hell they like within the law, of course. If you want to boost, especially local radio and things like that, why can't we have political adverts on TV and radio? Why can political parties and groups spend a load of money doing on YouTube, a load of money on Facebook, a load of money on Twitter pushing all this stuff, but you can't have it on TV and radio? And I think actually a great way to boost turnout during some big prime time specials in the mainstream media would be have 30-second clips during the general election, before the general election, from the different political parties. I think we need a radical rethink on this, and I want to see a real excitement. I mean, imagine local radio stations, as I say. If you had locally political parties, and obviously the adverts would be regulated, they'd have to be made sure that they're not lying and that, you know, certain things are adhered to, the law. So it wouldn't be like the Wild West. But what a boost that would be to the media, who is, by the way, advertising in the media is tanking at the moment. So it would be a big boost. And as you say, to have different news channels that's editorially driven, that's where we are. This is the modern world. The idea that we have to have people like Jon Snow on TV pretending that they're neutral, we all know they're not. People are not stupid. People will not be taken for fools anymore. And Twitter's revealed it, John. Twitter's revealed it, because these people who call themselves correspondents, actually a lot of them are political activists who are trying to completely frame the debate in the way they want the whole time, go on TV, pretend to be neutral, and then you go on their Twitter feed and it's been an anti-Brexit plethora for the past few years. You know, we won't be taken for mugs. So look, let's have an honest debate, allow people to go on and editorially say what they believe.
And that is a man shooting from the lip. That's Michael Heaver, the former Brexit MEP, with his views. I'll be back next week with another outspoken guest. That's a ridiculous term. But somebody who just speaks and says what they feel. We surely need more of that. You've been listening to John Gaunt with Michael Heaver, my special guest, the Brexit MEP. I'll be back next week. This is Sputnik International. Until then, thanks for listening.
Shooting from the lip.
If you've got a view, I want to hear it. If you agree, I want to hear it. If you disagree, get in touch. Tell me why I'm wrong, but you better have a good argument.
This is Shooting from the Lip.